This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice.
Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts or redefining what it means to be creative.
I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Eli Koslansky.
And we're your host for Art Moves. Today, we'll be talking with Eli Koslansky. Now, Eli, tell us who you are.
I don't know how to describe me, but I...
You're from Flatbush. You're
I'm
New York,
originally from
Brooklyn.
East Flatbush, born and bred in Brooklyn, right? You know, basically, I don't know what percentage white Russian and white percentage Austrian, but that's my people come from, mm-hmm. basically.
But and, wasn't your grandfather here since the 1800s or 1890s. Something like that? Yeah, see, so you've been here, what, five generations or so? Something close to that?
Three, something like that. Three or four generations.
Yes.
Yeah, they're real characters. You know, one of the guys that, you know, they said they went 20 miles in the snow to go to school without shoes, you know, this kind
of thing. All of that. In Brooklyn, no less.
No, Russia.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah. And then my basic background, I've always been an artist. You know, mm-hmm. I went to Cooper Union for the Advancement Science of Art. You know, I have a degree from that. Had a guidance counselor who told me not to go to try for art school because of my grades. Mm-hmm. Because I'm a bit of a wild child, but I ended up having a scholarship for Pratt and Cooper, full scholarship. Mm-hmm. And from there, worked in South Street Seaport Museum and worked for museum design firms and, you know, doing interactive media.
Now, it says here, you're a wood carver, model maker, props maker, museum curator, ship model appraiser, museum retail store manager, and a strategist. I mean, it just goes on and on.
Yeah. That's an old life, yeah.
Right, right.
Now I'm not sure what I am.
That happens, right?
The license.
Older you get, it's like the more... I think that's when we realize just how timeless our spirits are, because there's so much more to us than what was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the only thing I think in short, and the only thing I could say about it, the value of it was that because I had one foot in a digital world and, you know, being the people, one of the firms that started interactive media in the world, and also at the same time having this intense, very traditional art background, carving, whatever it is, that, you know, I'm in a really amazing position to be able to do amalgams of some kind, hybrid. So, but you also have an interesting background.
I guess it is interesting because I'm one of these people that always wanted to have a backup plan. When I moved to New York, I wanted to pursue acting, but I needed a backup plan. So I went to the University of Michigan for graduate school, and then I worked at UC Berkeley for a bit. And then moved to New York City because I just felt this was the place for me. I felt that it had the energy that that would help me to just advance myself, so to speak. So, yeah, then from there, I worked at the Agency for Children's Services. And, you know, that was the day job. But I pursued my acting. I was recognized on the street for a play that I had done at the Roundabout, and that was the last time I was recognized for something like that.
Yeah, but you also translated into this wonderful TV show, Brooklyn
Hello.
Savvy.
Hello, you know, I'm not a person who really thinks about what she's done. Right. But yes, I do have a television show called Brooklyn Savvy. It's in its 18th season on WNYC.
Wow. Right. Amazon, too,
It was on Amazon Prime. It's got a very bright future. The other day, I was walking down the street, and this gentleman said to me, Brooklyn Savvy, social justice. And we were having those kinds of authentic conversations when it started back in 2009. So I used my acting background and then, of course, just my intellect to create this show because I wanted people to know that I also think. You know, sometimes when you're acting, you wonder, do people see me? No, I've always wondered that. It's not just acting. I've always wondered, do people see me? So therefore, I did this show to make sure people could see me. And I don't know whether that comes from, I don't know where that comes from, where that mindset comes from. But I've always had that as a undercurrent to myself. So
I guess with all creative people, they have this desire. They see the world in a certain way and they want to reveal it in a certain way, you know, probably more so, I guess, than most people do, or maybe it's innate to a certain extent, but also there's innate talents too that go with that. And there's a passion and desire to be able to share that.
And I think it's about the way that I'm showing up. Is that really who I am? You know, I've always wanted people to really get me. And sometimes they don't. Right. They just see what they may just see themselves, you know. So anyway, well, I'm getting a little esoteric here. I won't even say what I'm getting ready to say, but keep, yeah.
Yeah, more than half the time they don't even get themselves, so I wouldn't worry about that.
That's true. That's true. That's something I can let go of.
So why did you do Atmos? Why did you start this? How can you still do it?
Well, you know, I'm chair of the Brooklyn Arts Council, and I met this guy named Eli Kuslansky, who was my coach, was going to chair the advisory group that I wanted to create as a way of helping our board to truly understand what it means to be an artist, what it takes to be an artist, what is in this art world. I think sometimes there's a disconnect. You know, typically people on boards are bringing their expertise from their day jobs, but they may not really know the sector that they are making decisions around. So right. Meeting you, and the first thing you said to me was, what's the Brooklyn Arts Council? I'm like, oh, there's an issue here, you know, that the Brooklyn Arts Council isn't known. But to have those kinds of meaty conversations with you around art and what artists need and what art is, and just basically building my vocabulary as well as my awareness and understanding. You know, so having you join as the chair of the Brooklyn Arts Council advisory group and then coming up with this idea of a podcast, that's how we started this, it. Right. That's how it all started. Right. Because we really wanted to give a voice to art on multi-levels.
No, I agree. But I'm sitting here thinking, yeah, we're also like, you know, straight out of Central Casting.
Right. We were looking to get busy.
But, you know, I think the other thing, too, it also gives you access to you as an artist. You know what I mean? I think that's the other thing, too. But I do have a history with the Brooklyn Arts Council's predecessor. Mm-hmm. And actually did a show called Wellspring about public art fountains many, many years ago. And, but, you know, it just seemed to me, and not just the Brooklyn Arts Council, but many art councils, is that there's this really interesting evolution going on in the arts, you know, and everything too. And we talked about this idea about the next renaissance, which is a rebirth, you know. So the rebirth in my idea is that it's a relook at, and then it was a relook at Greek and Roman art and bring it into a new century. And for us, it's looking at the traditional arts and bring it into a new century of, you know, whatever it is. It's a digital technology, new advanced, you know, art making practices and materials, stuff like that. And I think we're very interesting cusp. And I think also is a new generation of artists. And to me, it seems like art councils need to be responsive to that, you know, need to be also in line with that. And they're not.
I think something that you said to me that really helped open up my understanding was how the pencil was tech at what changed things.
Oh yeah, Michelangelo.
Just the pencil. Yeah, right. Speak about that. That was good talk.
Well, there's a couple of things. You know what made me think of it was that I saw the Michelangelo drawing show, which is amazing, and realized, because it's in the show, that was drawn in chalk. It wasn't drawn in pencils. It wasn't invented yet. Mm-hmm. You know, but you know, perspective was an invention. You know, photography. And what was art before that? You know, those were all in some ways technical inventions, you know. Even winemaking is a technology. So the question is, now we have these incredibly and increasingly more available access to these really interesting technology like sensors and et cetera, et cetera. How do we use it? I'll give you one example. And I just found this recently because we won this very prestigious award for one of our projects. You know, I'm a principal at Unified Field. And they wanted us to do a LIDAR scan of the space, which is this technology that allows you to create a 3D model texture that's navigable, but you can do it with your iPhone. You know, and that's, who knows what that would lead to, you know what I mean? We're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. We're talking to basically ourselves.
I was going to say something too about what you were saying, and so often, a lot of art for me, and I've said this many times, is like pure entertainment value. And I don't necessarily, but I'm learning to really unpack it, you know, the language of art, what goes into it, the fact that there's research, there's collaborations, it's multidisciplinary. There's so much underneath the art that you see. Speak a little bit about that, if you might, or if you could, or if you would.
Well, I think I mean, this is shooting from the hip, but I think
shoot, baby.
Yeah, okay. I think the thing is that Out at Its Best is really a sort of snapshot, if you will, of not just a personal expression, but who people are, people, how they interact with, and what the world is about. How do we deal with non-sensual things? You know, it's interesting. In some ways, it came out of this really interesting aspect, anthropological aspect called the mimetic function, the mimic things. And we, as ancient people, needed it to be able to explain things they couldn't sense. You know, it's non-sensual stuff, mm-hmm. like why is the moon doing what it's doing, is things like that. So I think in some ways that's the genesis of it. So it really has this really incredible, rich connection to more than just, you know, eating and sleeping, living, the other kind of things we do.
Well, you know, you've often talked about cave drawings. It's what we do. You know, we need to express. We need to sing. We need to dance. We need to draw.
And document. And
all of that.
You know, again, when I talk about it, it's also Art at Its Best, because there's a lot of stuff I call welcoming to what they are.
I wonder,
puffy poetry.
Do we get it at its best, though, because of the financial aspects of it? Meaning, are there people that might be really good at a particular art, but they didn't have the opportunity to really explore it because
they may not
have had the stomach? And when it comes to the fact that in a lot of ways, you're living your life with a lot of risk. If you really, you know, or just that's what you want to do, and you're going to put all of it in this dream kind of thing. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah, no, I understand. But the thing is that fortunately—
And so do we miss good people?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm sure there's some really amazing, brilliant artists who are struggling to get their work out because either they're shy or because they're not good at working a room or they're not good at networking, you know, and unfortunately that's an aspect of a successful artist or any kind of arts, you know. I mean, I know one particular drummer, really talented drummer, but he doesn't have the gumption or the courage of whatever it is to put himself out in the way that he really needs to advance his career.
And I guess there is a piece of courage, but is there common sense too? You know, meaning I've always asked myself that.
Common sense, meaning,
well, can I really make, what is it going to look like if I try to make a living with this? You know, what am I going to be sacrificing? I'll need to send, if I want a family, I need to be able to support them. We're getting right back down to the fact that artists are not valued. You know, the time you spend becoming the artist, whatever kind of art it is, you're not getting paid for any of that. None of that happens.
Well, I guess that's why it pays for creators, let's say, not just artists, but dancers,
whatever it is,
be open. You know, I mean, how many, you know, I'm trying to remember. I think it was Nat King Cole. I might not get this right because I'm not a jazz expert, but he was a jazz piano player, but he sounded so much like Art Tatum, he became a singer. It's kind of like that. It's mm-hmm. like what other opportunities or pathways, so not to be stuck on a one way of it happening or being or looking like it. I think that really opens up things that you may or may not have thought about.
I agree, because when it comes to my television show, I had a woman say to me, and she's very successful, well, you know, it's like jumping off a cliff. You're going to have to go all in. And I'm like, jumping off a cliff?
Yeah.
I'm not jumping. You know, but I have to figure, you know, I guess what it is we have to figure out a way to bring our dreams to life in a way that makes sense for us.
Well, there's a lot. No, it's very interesting you said, but there's a big myth, this idea about burn the boats, you know, like that I forgot to explore mm-hmm. in Cortez, who it was that burned the boat so they couldn't go back to Spain or something like that. And that's like a lot of successful people don't do it that way. They lean into it. So, for example,
let's talk about that. For example,
the guys who started Google didn't quit their day job.
Right.
And the people who are really innovative are innovative in one aspect of their life mostly, but the rest of it is pretty mundane. Mm-hmm. See, this idea about going all in, sacrificing everything, it's like, you know, there's a lot of myths about this stuff.
Absolutely. Now, you talked about tech. How is art intersecting with tech? I mean, I see the right now.
Oh, huge.
I have this. Yeah. On my iPad, I downloaded Procreate, you know, that app.
Oh, yeah, it's a great app.
I love it. You know, I'm spray painting, I'm drizzling, I'm flickering, and I'm splattering.
We're going to have to take it away from you.
But the thing is, but then it's like,
no, kidding.
It was funny. I have a young artist friend because I often say to him, I'm like, well, you know, if I can do this and it looks good, then that's my art. So why art school? But then I saw what he did and it was better than mine, even though he was still playing with it on the computer. See,
yeah.
So there's so much, there's more to explain the more to it.
Well, the more to it. Well, there's a couple of things that unpacked about this. One is this idea about being trained.
Well,
because
there
are some amazing, like, I'll give you an example. Thomas Keller never went to a culinary school. He's one of the top chefs in the country.
That's right, because it was in him.
Yeah, because but also he found another pathway to get the knowledge and information about it. But you could, when you have something where the artwork is not just of itself, but also then has quotations to it or reference things, not just of what it's talking about, but of all this work, then it's in this rich fabric of a language, right? That this is where the training comes in. This is where, you know, whether it's through art school or not, you know, and you could see it. You can point it out to you. You know, here's a quick example. For example, if you look at a lot of Goya's paintings, they look like watercolor sketches for tapestry because that's what his job was. Right, so that kind of thing, right? You see, it refers to a lot of other things, not just only of itself. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you know, I love.
I know that didn't answer the question,
because but the bottom line is a question that really can't be answered in a lot of ways.
Which
I
is
guess.
What?
You know, but I look at that Procreate, and I'm like, but I didn't use my hand to do that. You see, so I feel like when it's digital, it still feels like it is not a Da Vinci, it is not a Michelangelo. How could it be? He used his own hand, you know, and of course they had others working with them. But how can that ever be that? You know, I mean,
well, it can. There's no reason why it can't be because it's another tool, right? Here's another thing about to talk about mythologies. The mythology is the primacy of the artisanal handmade thing, right? So you can have great art that's not in that realm, right? That's made through digital means. You know, that makes it no less, you know, the rest of that's a market condition. Like it's artisanal, therefore it's one of a kind and has greater value. But that's also in some ways a prejudice of the collector. And digital is also the millionth copy is a clone of the original one, so there's a market issue. But there's some people using digital means that are couldn't do it any other way that are brilliant. I mean, there's Wim Delavoye who does these laser cut Gothic constructions, but that's digital.
Now, that was my art. You can't see this, listeners. Uh-oh, he looked at it. He looked at it like, ugh.
But I think
it was color. It was, you know, I just have so much fun with that Procreate, quite honestly.
Well, I think in some ways for some people that's missing.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM.
And we're talking to each other, Tony Williams and
Eli Kislansky.
Yes, and we're having this really, I hope it's an interesting conversation about the layers of art, what it means to us, why we started Art Moves. And for me, I wanted to make art accessible. And I guess that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted it to go beyond the entertainment value. You know, the feast for my eyes. I think that people want to know what is underneath the art.
Yeah, they can. The thing about it is, like anything, it takes work. You have to really read about it and do some research on it or talk to people about it.
What are you reading?
Not necessary.
What would you suggest? If I'm someone who really wants to be more art literate, how do I begin?
Well, I think the best way to do it is to go to museums with an artist.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the best way to do it. Hey, make it fun, make it an activity, and, you know, get some insights about what you're looking at.
Hmm.
I think that's the simplest way, you know, or to talk to artists about what their work is and why they're doing it and things like that.
You know what I've been doing? I've been going to YouTube.
YouTube? Yeah, that's fine.
and there's this site called Great Art Explained. That's right.
Yeah.
I've been doing that. And I've also been, there's just a lot on YouTube when it comes to art and on Instagram. So you're a wonderful artist. I've seen your work.
Thank you. Yeah.
Now, what are some of the issues that you have getting your art out there?
The issues.
And you've been in this field for quite some time. Not to tell on you, but you know.
Yeah, I graduated from Cooper Union. I didn't know what the hell to do, so I went into the museum field and learned how to make model ships. Mm-hmm. But which is great, because the models are kind of intriguing because they're exist not just as an object in themselves, but there's definitely a powerful reference to a much larger thing, you know, and it's all depending how you make it, right? So that was kind of intriguing to me. But it's only recently in the last two or three years that I've always been working on my work, you know, doing sketches and models and things like that to figure out things.
But you do a lot of different things, like you'll do the metal work and then you do a lot of things.
And the lucky thing about it for me at this point, because when I was at Cooper, I had these thought experiments of how to use computers in art and, you know, and perception, you know, and actually did these thought experiments. But it was impossible to do because computer graphics didn't exist. So it was just not possible. And luckily now at this point, I have the knowledge and the skills and also the availability of computer programs and the technology to do the kind of things I wanted to do many years ago. So the challenge I have is that even though I think the work's really good, the response has been amazing about it, because a lot of people say, wow, mm-hmm. including some senior person at Sotheby's and whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't have a exhibition history because I haven't been exhibiting.
Right.
So
is that in the way?
I don't think it's in the way per se. It's just a handicap, mm-hmm. because, you know, you're like anything, gallerists and art organizations are risk adverse. But to me, you know, this part of me says, who cares? You know what I mean? It's like,
do you?
I just do me. And I don't say this out of arrogance, but, you know, it's a thought experiment. It's like Da Vinci walked into a gallery, had no exhibition history. Would they say no?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, it's like, right. Okay, whatever. Not saying I'm Da Vinci.
I was getting ready to say, okay.
No, I'm not saying I'm Da Vinci. I'm just saying that, you know, it's just as a thought experiment. So I don't know. It's just, you know, let me know, you know, come back to me in the air, I'll tell you.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about how artists are out-of-the-box thinkers. There's a lot of thought that goes into art, you know?
Yeah.
And talk about that, meaning the inquiry, the way that when you do a piece, what's underneath it? What is it that you're trying to express or explain or interrogate? Because that's the word that I see a lot. Interrogate.
Right. Yeah, it's a good. I mean, every artist has a different drivers, you know. And for me, maybe because of my interests, or varied backgrounds, or the skills I've acquired, or whatever it is that and maybe it's one of these quixotic things or something like that. But I want to push the boundaries of what is art and how people think about it, you know. What is sculpture, ideas about sculpture? And, you know, it again goes back to this thinking about, like, if you look at a lot of art, a lot of that stuff, like 80, 90% of it, there's no reason why it couldn't have been done in the 1920s or before. So then the question is, what's the art that's truly of our time? What would that look like? You know, and then what are the unexplored areas about it? You know, for example, here I'm gonna give you an example. One of the things I'm experimenting with is, you know, what people call moiré patterns, using these multiple stainless steel rods and stuff like that. But, you know, I don't think that's really been really explored as a study per se, right? So what that does is that it then shifts sculpture from just being about outline and form and light to the mechanics of light itself, because it uses interference patterns, right? It's called interferometry. That's the word for it.
What is that? For those who are listening that don't
right.
know
so what it is that you could do this with your fingers. You ever do this with your fingers and you put them close together and all of a sudden it looks like they're closing together, but
right.
it's not really touching?
Exactly.
What you're actually doing is canceling light waves. Mm-hmm. So that's not shadow. That's no light. Right? So the interesting thing about that is it's incredibly accurate. They actually use that to measure microscopic things. They use it because it's so accurate, to like 0.00 millionth of an inch. But they also use it to measure things in outer space.
Hmm.
Right? So here's this phenomena of the absence of light as an element in sculpture.
Interesting.
Right.
That's the connection you would have never necessarily made at all.
And it's been since the School of Paris and stuff, people have been playing with moiré patterns.
Hmm.
But what's behind that? You know, how to go deep into that, right? The other thing I'm experimenting this idea with, I just did this yesterday. You know, I was thinking about public art, you know, the permanence of public art, right? And I was thinking about entropy. So we created this little maquette. It's got a piece of limestone, and it's got this very thin piece of rustable steel. So if you look at it, you look at the piece of it, and you say, oh, that's the form. But in actuality, the steel is really like ink for an ink drawing. Because over a 30-year period, it's going to rust and create stains mm-hmm. onto the limestone piece. Then if that's the question, why couldn't you create a public art thing of varying thicknesses? Then it would also deteriorate a certain, it would corrode at different periods of time over a certain period and reveal itself. See, that's the way to think about public art sculpture that's not traditional.
I see, right? I see. What about art and, say, topics of our time right now? You know, yes, we can be very literal and we can see a picture of George Floyd, a mural or something of that nature. But I hope this isn't asking too much, but how would that, with what you said, how does social justice fit into the kind of work you're doing, or does it? Or does it? Maybe that's the question.
It doesn't, no.
Yeah, it just doesn't.
No, it just doesn't.
It just does it.
I think doing the radio show is my contribution to social justice, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. but in the work, it's more phenomenologically based.
Absolutely,
you know,
absolutely.
It's more aesthetic and plastic art and phenomenology based, not because I'm not passionate about social justice. I am.
No, I get you.
Not the way the work, you know, in some ways, I had a professor at Cooper, because I asked him when a painting is finished. And he said there was three times a painting is finished. There's once when you're finished, once when the painting's finished, and the third time when you're both finished together.
So what does the together look like?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a painter, so I don't know. Right. But I think I got a B in that. Anyway, so the thing is that it's almost like the work itself calls you. You know what I mean? You have to have, it's like there's you that you put into it, but also the work is calling you to a certain extent to follow things certain ways.
So if the work calls you.
And by the way, the other reason about that, there's a lot of work out there like that, you know. And for me, I think that it's not that it's a level of interest, it's that if I'm trying to do something unique, you know, and push the boundaries of the field to a certain extent, I don't think for me it makes a lot of sense to do a lot of other people are doing. I mean, a lot. And it's great they're doing that. I'm not, you know,
I hear you. It gives you your uniqueness. But getting back to the work calling you, does your work come from your mind, that intellectual part of yourself, or does it come from your heart, more that emotional center, or does it come from both, or does it come from way outside of you? Does it come from your higher self?
Yeah, no, I think primarily from the higher self.
Oh, okay.
I think from the spiritual sense, because that's the curious piece about it. And it reminds me of something I heard about this, and I might not get this right, of this organization, this religion called Sukiyo Marikari, and what they believe is a divine light. And they say that when it's like they believe your ancestors all the way going up to the heavens is giving you divine light by holding your hand up. And they point out, if you look at a lot of religious paintings, you always see like Jesus and all with the hands raised up like that, because they're giving divine light. That's the best way to describe it. Right.
And I think that is a wonderful place to close. That's a wonderful place to close. So we've been talking to each other. I'm Tony Williams.
I'm Eli Kislansky.
And we've been talking about Art Moves.
Art Moves is co-produced by Brick Arts Media and pre-recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn.